Alina Holoshka is a board member of the Ukrainian NGO Anti-Corruption Action Center and co-founder of the International Center for Ukrainian Victory. She has also worked as a chief of international advocacy at the Post-Maidan Coalition of 80 CSOs, the Reanimation Package Reforms, and Alina is a contributor to the Atlantic Council, Kyiv Independent, and many other publications. She's also written op-eds for the Washington Post, Foreign Policy, and the EU Observer. Welcome to Silicon Curtain Podcast. If you enjoy our guests, and I know many of you absolutely do, firstly, you'll recognize that Alina has been on the channel a number of times now and is an extremely fierce and very eloquent advocate for Ukraine. But please do like, subscribe, share these videos around, and definitely add comments, because it does help new people to discover these incredibly important voices. And do check out the validated Ukrainian charities, which appear in the description of the video. Alina, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, for having me.
So let's dive straight into probably what is a minefield topic, and it's something that has got many Ukrainians, I think, upset. Now, Ukraine is very rational. You have to be, given where you are, and given you are bordered by an extremely irrational, and I would say, you know, traumatized and emotional country, which is Russia. But the fact that France, US, UK immediately sent up planes and equipment to take down Iranian missiles, demonstrated that where there's the will, there is the equipment and capability to do this. And I think it upset a lot of people, understanding that that same will was not being applied to Ukraine.
Well, indeed, that is the question which a lot of Ukrainians are asking ourselves. Of course, we think that what the allies have done to defend Israel from the Iranian terrorist missiles and drones was the right thing to do. What we are questioning is why the same things are not done against Iranian drones and missiles, which Russia is firing along with North Korean missiles and their own missiles and drones at Ukraine. Unfortunately, from our perspective, this displays a strong fears of the allies, because they could have closed the sky of Ukraine in the first weeks of the full-scale war, when we had a very large campaign, Close the Sky, and we were asking, you know, the allies to help us with shooting down the air targets and, you know, ground missions we would be able to perform ourselves. But unfortunately, that didn't happen, and it costed Ukraine a lot. And particularly painful this was very recently, because in March and April this year, Russia significantly intensified their missile and drones attack against our energy infrastructure. And just yesterday, President Zelensky said that Russia destroyed almost all of our capacity of the thermal power generation. And this is the cost of inaction, unfortunately. And if you talk, for example, about Kharkiv alone, Russians destroyed all of the energy and heating facilities in the town and substations. And mayor told that the renewal is actually impossible. You have to rebuild from scratch, which would take years and $10 billion. And, you know, it's not even and only about closing the sky, which from our perspective would be sending the message to Russia from the position of strength, because Russia is used to NATO countries speaking to them from the position of weakness, so-called escalation management, you know, when the West put surrounded itself with the red lines, self-imposed and which they do not cross unless Russia does something extraordinary bad. But this genocidal war is extraordinary bad in its core. You do not have to wait for Russia to do something next, even worse than they have done. But even on the background of that, Ukraine isn't receiving air defense systems, missiles to the air defense systems. I mean, Russian air campaign against Ukraine in March and April was so effective, particularly because our missiles were almost out and the aid packages stalled and were not coming. And, you know, when Ukrainians are seeing allies kind of, you know, defending Israel and simultaneously abandoning the aid for Ukraine fully, and while they actually committed to support us, you know, within the Budapest Memorandum, under which we gave up third largest nuclear arsenal, realizing that only nuclear arsenal is actually the deterrent and the security in the modern world. I mean, that is, of course, disheartening.
And that's what I was going to mention there. Of course, two of the countries that were shooting down the Iranian drones, namely the US and the UK, are signatories to the Budapest Memorandum. And even though that didn't provide concrete commitments to ensure Ukraine's security, it did suggest that and imply that these two countries would be guarantors of Ukraine's sovereignty, ironically, in conjunction with the third country as the signatory, the one which is violating Ukraine's sovereignty.
I think that it's very important to understand, and that's something, the message which we try to convey at our high-level meetings with Western decision makers, is that the war in 2024 changed dramatically from the war in 2014. Because back then it was just Russia against Ukraine. Today it's the coalition of tyrannies that are testing how to apply the might, you know, the might is right approach, or substitute the international world rules-based order with the order of force and order of might. And I think that this particular case with Budapest Memorandum is unfortunately contributing to many countries asking themselves what can be effective guarantees of their sovereignty and of their security, because international law completely failed this task. That's, I mean, that's the fact, you know. And what countries are seeing, and this is, of course, this coalition of dictatorship, but not only, all of the other third countries, is that if you have nukes, you can protect yourself. And I think that this can be, unfortunately, a very big blow to the, you know, decades-long non-proliferation efforts. And it will be very complicated, you know, to deter other countries from developing, exchanging, buying nuclear technologies, in case if they are seeing that, you know, Ukraine gave up their nukes and presently we are fighting for our survival. And to be honest, the situation is very complicated. And, you know, the aid is not coming and we have to come up with plenty of different advocacy ideas, new solutions, you know, op-eds, campaigns in order to ask for air defenses, which is not even, you know, an offensive weapon. It is something which all of the countries already committed to be helping us. And President Zelensky, Minister Kuleba are seeking, desperately seeking for Patriot air defense systems. And only Germany committed, you know, to send us additional system. Unfortunately, other countries who have them standing idle are not sharing because they might need them, you know, in the future. Well, they will need them in the future if they let Russia win in Ukraine and contribute to the triumph of the Russian imperialism, which will definitely one day cross the border of the NATO country, invade, and will bring its violence, terrorism, and savageness to other democratic states.
That's right, and there's so many different angles to follow up there. Now, you may not want to point the finger at individual politicians, but the US has been conducting a policy of escalation management. I think that is absolutely clear. And one of the chief architects of that policy is Jake Sullivan, who many people 6 months ago would not have heard of. Now, I think amongst those who are ardent Ukraine watchers, that name is unfortunately quite familiar. The irony, isn't it, that in escalation management, which is designed to control risk from authoritarian states, seems to have massively exaggerated increasing that risk. You've talked about the proliferation of nuclear weapons. It was supposed to control that. It's gone the opposite direction. It was supposed to contain aggression. Russian aggression is getting more and more intense as it converts its entire economy, education, media, onto a genocidal war footing. We have the Middle East in flames, etc. It is a monumental failure. Are you detecting some realization in political circles that this is a failed strategy and that a new strategy is now required?
Well, we've been talking about the failure of this approach basically from the very beginning in 2022, when it was absolutely clear that in the protracted war, it would be very complicated, close to impossible for Ukraine to win, because it is Russia which is destroying our economy, energy system, infrastructure, and, you know, everything which we need to function as the operational economy and state. Our mobilization potential and manpower is much smaller because we are a smaller country. And Russians are mobilizing, you know, people into their army absolutely illegally from the occupied territories. So they are basically, you know, taking away Ukrainians. They are kidnapping Ukrainian kids, so killing our future generation. So we think that the nature of this war is absolutely genocidal war. And it was definitely clear for us, you know, from the very beginning that the resources need to come in time and in sufficient quantities. Because take a look at the case with, let's say, modern battle tanks. I mean, they arrived in spring 2023. They didn't manage to bring wow effect on the battlefield because Russia was gifted plenty of time to build sophisticated defense lines, particularly in the south. If those tanks were supplied by the autumn 2022 counteroffensives in Kherson and Kharkiv regions, they could have made something, you know, groundbreaking back then. Presently, we are seeing absolutely the same mistake repeated with the long-range missiles. And here I mean, of course, Taurus missiles. Because, you know, as General Ben Hodges always explains, that from the military perspective, liberating Crimea is probably the easiest part because it has a very, you know, strong bottleneck or small bottleneck, which is Crimea Bridge. And if you manage to destroy it, you basically cut logistics from the entire peninsula because Ukrainian, you know, special forces managed to do excellent operations and to push Russian Black Sea Fleet from Crimea to Novorossiysk and other ports, meaning that supplies, you know, through the ships are also much more complicated, while we did ensure the freedom, more or less freedom of navigation in the Black Sea. But what our partners are presently doing, they are gifting Russia time to build railroads, you know, connecting Crimea Peninsula with Russia through the southern occupied regions of Ukraine. If they manage to complete those railways, it would be much more complicated to disrupt the supply chains of the peninsula from the aggressor state. And, you know, if we do manage to receive those Taurus missiles in, let's say, 2-3 years, and then they do not have wow effect, we will again hear that we told you that it's not going to be a game changer. Game changing is about timeliness, and it's about the sufficient quantities, because, you know, 30 tanks compared to the length of the front line, you know, comparing to what we have during the world wars, I mean, it's unfortunately not going to be a significant change. So for us, I mean, you know, back in 2022, we were asking our partners very directly that what is your plan if Ukraine runs out of soldier, if we run out of people? And now we started hearing from some of the partners, particularly in Europe, that they are preparing for the direct war with Russia. But here we also have a kind of a two lines of their possible actions. First is give Ukraine everything, everything, even in the, if this in the short-term perspective means that you are somehow weakening your own stocks, but for the sake of helping Ukraine to win, survive as the democratic state, and, you know, continue being one of the pillars of the transatlantic and European security. And other countries, you know, start kind of collecting all this material, equipment, weapons for themselves, because in case Russia attacks Ukraine, falls, they need to have weapons, which from our perspective is a very selfish approach, because that's about using Ukraine and Ukrainians as a shield for your own, you know, rearming. And I liked very much yesterday the statement of Secretary General Stoltenberg, who said it very clearly, that in between choosing, you know, to comply with your 2% of GDP commitment or sending whatever you can to Ukraine, please do choose the second one, because the best way to win war is to avoid war, because when the war starts, and when you're already dragged into it, it's kind of very complicated, you know, to win. I'm not even speaking about the senseless killings, a lot of human lives wasted, lost, you know, for the sake of not stopping evil imperialism in time when there was an excellent opportunity to stop it with the minimal costs and with the minimal losses.
And to stay on that military theme, something that doesn't get repeated nearly enough is that not only does Ukraine have the largest army in Europe, it also has the most experienced people. Now, many, of course, have come from civilian backgrounds, but through more than 10 years of warfare against Russia and the full-scale war, you have many tens of thousands of people with extraordinary experiences and now, I would say, talent for war. It is insane to shrink that amount by not giving them the equipment they need, losing experienced people, and not, as you say, leaning upon them. Because, no offense to Western armies, Ukrainians have shown that they can innovate and that they can strike back and that they understand Russian techniques and they can achieve a far higher ratio of KIAs, destruction of Russian armor and Russian human resources. They can achieve that if given the right weapons. So it's, in your view, is it utterly nonsensical not to support Ukraine at this time and to carry on, as you say, unfortunately attriting Ukrainian forces? It's an incredible waste.
Jonathan, you're absolutely right from my perspective. I mean, I'm not even touching the perspective of humanity and, you know, the utter price of the human life and knowing that the partners have the right tools and capacities to help us save those human lives, we are not kind of achieving this. But let's put this human dimension aside and think strategically. You are more than right that our army has the strongest, you know, and the best combat experience, because Ukrainian army is fighting the war, which actually were never fought, I would say, anywhere in the world after World War II, because even those wars that were fought, you know, including with the participation of the allies, they were absolutely different. So they had, you know, first air operation, and then, you know, there was the full coverage of the ground forces. And it wasn't, you know, that the army is basically sitting in the trenches without any air cover and doing literally miracles with the drones, with the jamming system, with a lot of the innovations, you know, literally, you know, thought out kind of a couple of weeks ago. And I liked very much how the former president of Estonia, Ilves Tomas, put it, I think a year ago or something like that. He said, I mean, he was addressing his fellow Europeans, and he said that, do you understand if we are destined to fight this war against Russia, Russia attacking us? I mean, you would want Ukrainians to be fighting it by your side, because it's time to stop considering Ukraine as the burden, as the troublemaker, as, you know, somebody who only kind of absorbs, takes, wastes, and doesn't contribute. Ukraine has stopped the second largest army in the world, with everybody predicting, you know, it to take over our state in 3 days. And I have the feeling, you know, that people tend to forget what is the enemy we are fighting against, with very limited resources, incredibly limited resources. And this Black Sea story, from our perspective, is very unfairly underreported, because when everybody was focused on what could be our successes in the ground liberation, when Russia did have enough time to build very sophisticated defense lines, which you simply cannot cross, even on the Abrams or Leopard 2 tanks. Ukraine did manage to show miracles in the Black Sea, to basically, you know, provide the freedom of navigation in the western part of the Black Sea, and, you know, Ukrainian grain deal, how we call it, Ukrainian grain corridor, is much more effective than the one which was brokered by the UN and Turkey, which Russia abused, which again proves that, you know, the best deal is victory over Russia, because anything short of victory, be it victory in the battle or be it victory in the war, would be Russia abusing, you know, their negotiation ceasefire. And, well, to be honest, there was recently this article in the Foreign Affairs where two analysts, including Samuel Cherap, who kind of tried to analyze the potential negotiations which could have happened in spring 2022, and they were portraying this as if, you know, Russia was committed to any peace, that, you know, there were statements like Russia showed unique readiness for concessions. I mean, no, Russia never ever wanted any peace negotiations. Their only goal is to subjugate or destroy Ukraine. They are ready to play long. They are ready to do some, let me put it, tactical retreats, but only in order to hit strategically much harder. And unless people understand what is the real intention of the enemy, which is to take over Ukraine and then move forward to Europe, because Russia is clear, they want Eurasia from Lisbon to Vladivostok under their sphere of influence without any, you know, engagement of the United States here. And unless people understand this, and unless they understand that occupation is not peace, occupation is a large concentration camp, then, you know, we will be hearing this, you know, the doves of peace. Ukraine should just stop shooting, etc., etc. But I mean, that only shows that people do not understand the underlying reasons of this war, and that other dictators are watching very closely, taking notes and planning their own adventures. Because if Russia is allowed to use nuclear blackmail and conquer Ukraine in the strategic perspective, all of other dictators will realize that, you know, they would just need to kind of endure the first time, which might be somehow painful, but then they will adjust because, you know, there will be plenty of different loopholes for the circumvention. And then nobody will care about what they want, you know, to achieve, how they want to achieve, and then they will simply legitimize it. I mean, what Russia is doing in Ukraine is trying to rewrite world order, hoping that this won't influence the life of people in Europe, North America, Latin America, Africa, is very short-sighted and very naive.
And it is extraordinary. I'm going to do a special episode on the report that Charup and Sergei Radchenko has written, because, as you say, it has appalling language that seeks to ignore the actions of Russia and look at what essentially is a piece of intelligence product. Their written words say one thing, their actions speak to something else. And that's to ignore the entire process of the Minsk Accords, which essentially has been admitted now by Russian strategists and propagandists, that this was simply a front to reject the idea that Russia somehow was a good faith actor, that somehow its assault on Ukraine was not imperial in character. So there's plenty of examples of this. You could go back to Stalin's constitution of the USSR in the 1930s, and on paper, it was one of the most enlightened documents of any state, one of the most advanced on paper constitutions. At the same time, he's busy killing tens of millions of his own citizens. So actions and words are clearly two different things. You talked about funding as well in your answer. And this is a topic, again, I think there needs to be a lot of attention on. We've just done a full episode on it, but I think it's very important to get your view on this. And how important is taking the seized Russian assets, the $300 billion, and getting those to Ukraine, not putting in place sort of funny little schemes to just use the interest or use them as collateral for loans? These have been shown to be unrealistic. How important is it to not just Ukrainian victory, but to European security, that money is made available ASAP?
Just again, yesterday there was the statement of the head of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, who said that unlike Russia, which is violating international law, the West has to very nobly stick to international law and not kind of repeat what Russia is doing, which from my perspective is a very kind of simplistic approach, because what European Central Bank, which very fairly, of course, cares about the stability of euro, and even the very minor fluctuations is kind of something which they try to avoid and want to avoid. It's their job, of course. But I think that what is very much missing in the statements or comments of the Madame Lagarde and other you know, financial experts who are commenting on the topic is that they have to speak about the alternatives. And if Madame Lagarde says that confiscation is impossible because that would be very dangerous for Europe, but Ukraine losing the war and tens of millions of Ukrainian refugees fleeing European Union immediately because they would try to escape genocide is not as dangerous for the future and stability of Europe, I think it would be, you know, more fair way to build the discussion, because nobody speaks about the alternatives. And of course, if you take a look at the confiscation in vacuum, it's an unprecedented step. Well, that's true. I mean, you know, there's no convention on the Russian responsibility for the war of aggression against Ukraine, where you are having Article 2022, you know, saying that Russian assets must be confiscated. But world order is facing incredibly unprecedented challenges since World War II. And international law did not manage to have the sufficient safeguards against such violations. Moreover, international law has plenty of safeguards to defend and secure the aggressors, which they are also taking notes, you know, thinking how they are going to be defend themselves when the other dictators are engaging in their own wars and aggressions, which from our perspective is also very dangerous, because we try to explain that confiscation would basically be a positive precedent, because that would act as a deterrent against other aggressions. If they know that their wars, unprovoked wars, would be met with the number of tools and instruments of accountability and confiscation of assets would be one of them, it might be, you know, the strong argument against the wars of aggression. And, you know, when this heads of financial institutions are assessing and commenting on the topic from a very narrow perspective, well, I think, you know, it's a job of journalists to be asking them right questions, like what would be the implications of Ukraine losing for the stability of Europe? And are you sure that those implications would be lighter comparing to a confiscation of Russian assets? Because, of course, we would want our partners to support us with kind of, you know, let me put it, more typical, more usual sources of aid. But the package of Ukrainian for Ukraine's assistance cannot go through the Congress since September, and it's already mid-April. I mean, yes, there are some cautiously optimistic news, and maybe when you post this video, we would already have the aid package adopted. But I mean, half a year costed Ukraine a lot. What I've already said with regards to our energy security and the destroyed a lot of thermal and hydropower plants, entire energy system of Kharkiv, countless lives, countless objects of the civilian infrastructure, residential houses, etc. This is the cost of the aid delays. So, of course, we speak a lot with the European partners that they have to come up with a sustainable sources for the aid of Ukraine. And there are a few plans, like the plan of Kaya Kallas for $100 billion fund, or 0.25% of GDP donated to Ukraine from all of the countries. And there's also plan of Stoltenberg, also for $100 billion. It's still not clear whether these are the same plans or competing plans, whether it would be one of them or two of them. But I mean, you know, that's time. And all those plans, they require plenty of negotiations, you know, setting, shaping, etc. We don't have those this time. And we have to think about the sustainable sources for Ukraine's aid. And we think that confiscation of Russian assets is actually, you know, moral, just, but it would also be legal and financially possible, because you touched upon that, you know, international partners are debating on the possible kind of so-called intermediary creative solutions. But we also have to understand that international lawyers, I mean, not Ukrainian international lawyers, but American, European, there are Belgian professors, British, German, French, they made a very strong and solid case for the full confiscation as the countermeasure. If our partners do not use the solid ground for confiscation as countermeasure and instead decide to go for the something in between, they might actually, you know, themselves undermine the core basis for this confiscation, because you already have the model, you have the sufficient grounds, just go ahead and do it and not think out something which is even more sophisticated than confiscation. And, you know, put yourself in the trap of even more legal uncertainty and financial uncertainty without providing Ukraine with sufficient resources, which is, of course, at this stage, instrumental, because Ukraine is not in the stage of kind of offensives or the reconstruction. We are back to the stage of survival. And in the stage of survival, all of the resources should be mobilized as soon as possible for the survival.
And as you say, speed is of the essence and not the sort of incremental delays that we've seen over the last 2 years that have had such a negative impact. Well, there's two areas I'd like to cover in the remaining time we've got, because in the videos on the channel at the moment, we're really trying to focus on what is most important to drive Ukrainian victory. Well, survival, victory, and recovery, I think, comes later. Even though that's a favorite topic of many Western analysts, I think you have to win before rebuilding. Just logical, unfortunately. And there's two topics which are incredibly important. One is stop the delays. The other one is stop putting red lines in the way of Ukraine. And of course, the oil refineries, the incredibly powerful strategy of Ukraine to hit Russian oil and energy facilities. Not only is it my view that that should continue to take out as much of that capacity, it should actually increase and be expanded to the pipeline system that delivers crude oil for export. Now, there is some debate about whether that would constitute a war target, but at this point, this seems to be an incredibly powerful strategy and the only one in 2 years that has really spooked the Kremlin and got them concerned, genuinely concerned. What should Ukraine do? Should it ignore the concerns of allies and go fully to take out Russian oil infrastructure? And how important do you think could that be as part of a victory strategy?
Well, I think that it is very important to put this question of the attacks on refineries, which, by the way, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe a couple of days ago officially kind of recognized as the legitimate oil targets, you know, comparing to the statements of other officials. But we have to put this into the two-year context of the Western energy sanctions, because the West had 2 years to impose the sanctions on the Russian oil and gas to make sure that they are, on one hand, effective, on the other hand, do not backfire at the Western partners. But they completely failed to do this. I mean, they introduced on one hand the price cap, which was $60 per barrel of crude oil, and which, according to the experts, energy experts, is already pretty high. So, you know, in order for it to make sense, it had to be like minimum two times smaller, or preferably, you know, $10 per barrel instead of present $60. But even this kind of a pretty high price cap wasn't properly implemented because there was no instruments to sanction those that are that were helping Russia to circumvent sanctions. And here we speak particularly regarding Greek shipping companies that were mostly transporting Russian oil, and European Union decided that for them, you know, the well-being of certain Greek oligarchs is much more important than decreasing the ability of Russia to be waging this war. And in 2022, 2023, Russia has earned on selling this fossil fuels, oil, gas, oil products. I mean, they were selling less of the pipeline gas, but instead they started selling LNG gas also to Europe. So on the one hand, you know, Europe was saying that we are giving up on the Russian gas, but that was partially true because they were giving up on the pipeline gas and substituting it with LNG. So on all of that, Russia has earned $650 billion. With the incomes like that, Russia can be waging this genocide indefinitely. So on one hand, we have Western energy sanctions, which ended up Russia having super profits and Russian war machine having enough resources to be waging this war. On the other hand, we are not receiving ourselves even basic, you know, air defenses, missiles, ammunition. Russia is outnumbering us, you know, 10 times or even more in the artillery ammunition. And we are basically fighting against a much stronger enemy, almost barehanded. So, of course, Ukraine tries to survive and tries to apply all of the possible and available tools and capacities which we are having in order to undermine Russian war machine. So I think that if, you know, our partners have some concerns regarding our attacks on oil refinery, the right way for them would be not to criticize us for trying to survive in this genocidal war, but instead making some truly revolutionary steps, you know, that can cut significantly the Russian incomes. You know, that might be significantly lowering down the price cap to, let's say, $10 or even $5 per barrel, and introduce the criminal liability for the circumvention of sanctions. Other idea the energy experts are coming with is so-called surcharge tax or tariff, which could be, you know, proportionally increasing on the Russian trade of fossil fuels if Russia is further destroying in the terrorist attacks our energy infrastructure. And let's say even if this tax would have been imposed at the minimal level of, let's say, 10% in 2022-2023, Russia would get $65 billion less income. And this money could have been, you know, basically redirected for Ukraine for our self-defense. So that would have been, you know, killing two birds with one stone. And, you know, I think that it's very much unfair to be tying our hands behind our back when the resources for our survival are not coming in time. So either Western partners are getting very, very serious about bankrupting Russian war machine, and that regards, first of all, energy system, because that's their main source of income, or Ukraine will, of course, continue defending itself with all of the possible means.
The last question is very much related to that, and again, it comes down to political will. And I think this is the last loophole that the West should have closed a long time ago. And this is the export of various consumer goods, but also components that could be used in the military war machine. They're going via third countries. It's obvious what's happening in the spike in trade with Kazakhstan and other states bordering on Russia. It's clear and obvious, and it's a matter of greed. It clearly is a matter of greed and corporate politics, not enlightened foreign policy. Russia's war machine is still being supplied with the goods that it needs that are coming from Western countries. And of course, components for its war machine are finding their way there. You also mentioned oil and being able to sort of hit that on the ground of Russia. There is another tactic, which I'd love to hear your view of whether we should adopt this. Russia has created a gray fleet using ancient hulks, ancient ships, and it is also transferring oil at sea in order to sort of cleanse the origin, and countries, various countries are colluding in that trade. It's an ecological time bomb. Should NATO close the Baltic? And does it have the grounds, one, to target the components and the goods that are ending up in Russia? Secondly, does it have the legal and military grounds to close the Baltic Sea to Russian shipping on the grounds that Russia is violating every international agreement and every ecological convention that is designed to protect those precious marine environments?
Well, you know that I'm very hawkish in my statements and foreign policy views. I think that NATO should close not only Baltic Sea, but also Black Sea, because Russia is causing a lot of the disaster in the Black Sea as well. And that's the matter of the national security of European countries. And of course, Baltic Sea is already NATO Sea, and Black Sea also has a lot of the NATO countries, you know, having them. So it's the matter of the national security interest. This thing of the circumvention of sanctions related to the technology and dual use goods, well, from our perspective, it's absolutely scandalous. And just a couple of days ago, I heard in Norway that during the World War II, they had a special notion to call companies like that. They called them six column. You know, when on one hand, they are kind of allegedly sticking to all of those, you know, values, supporting their own states, because most are still from China, but a lot are Western based. I mean, they are paying taxes in the Western countries. They are allegedly following the Western, you know, geostrategic vectors. But at the same time, you know, it doesn't prevent them from selling to the enemy of the components that are used for killing. So that has to change. And you were absolutely right that it's definitely clear already what are the routes for those components to end up in the Russian weapons. Usually these are through the companies in Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkey, other countries. And, you know, when the company all of a sudden after February 2022 received the largest clients that are in Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, who didn't have, you know, that any prior experience in the area, and all of a sudden they are buying, you know, almost all of their production, that's a red flag, which has to, you know, motivate those companies to do some due diligence and collect some intelligence and, you know, stop trading with those clients. So from my perspective, with the technology sanctions, we have absolutely the same problem as with the energy sanction. When the greed of the several private entities basically outweighs with of the survival of the nation. And that's why I think that sanctions are very important. That's a very good direction of work. They has to be toughened significantly, especially with the implementation, application of sanctions and criminal liability for the circumvention of sanctions. But relying purely on sanctions as a victory strategy, it's not a good thing to do. So, you know, it can only be reinforcing the main channel of the support, which should be military aid, maximum military aid as soon as possible. And sanctions will come, you know, as the kind of a secondary support. That's why we have to focus on that. We have to continue pushing our partners to ask them unpleasant but very urgent questions. And so that's, from my perspective, the way to go.
And I think, you know, just a final comment on that. I've seen a change in the tone of Zelensky's speeches. He is less enthralled to the US. He's always polite, but he's more firm and direct, and he's articulating the costs and the challenges of not supporting Ukraine. And I think that firming up of language is incredibly important, that being blunt and open with partners and explaining the consequences of delay and inaction. And it's good to see at last that sort of tone changing. Sometimes Ukrainians can be too humble. It's not a characteristic we associate with your neighbor, but humility is a great quality. But right now, obviously, force is required, strong words, strong actions. Elena, you represent all these things, incredibly sort of, you know, forceful and clear thought and expression. So I'm so pleased to have you on the channel again. And I advise people to follow you on Twitter, LinkedIn, where you post some of the most important information and insight. But thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and priorities with our audience today.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you very much for this important work of delivering, helping, amplifying the voices of Ukrainians, Ukraine experts, because with the media coverage decreasing, it is incredibly important that people continue getting the right news, the right expertise in order to understand what is at stake and what needs to be done to support Ukraine more. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for your audience, because they are amazing people with a lot of the engagements, usually a lot of different comments. And thank you very much for supporting Ukraine as well. We are very harsh, especially recently, because a lot has been at stakes. But I think that it's very important to keep repeating that we appreciate, recognize, and acknowledge the incredible contribution of many, many people across different levels, you know, both ordinary people, people in the government, you know, journalists who are helping us to continue keeping Ukraine very high on the political agenda. And I think that it's important that you know that we know, we see this, we appreciate it. And thank you very much for being with us.